From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The movie Secretary is an offbeat comedy about an unusual office romance between a lawyer and his assistant who slowly develop a sadomasochistic relationship. The dominance and submission is oddly liberating for them. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the director, Steven Shainberg. Also, we meet a new jazz singer, Susie Arioli, and guitarist Jordan Officer. And for Halloween, film critic David Edelstein recommends some modern horror movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Minnesota Supreme Court has ordered state election officials to send out new absentee ballots to people who request to change their Senate vote after the death of Senator Paul Wellstone. Minnesota Democrats had asked the court to go farther, canceling the absentee votes that have already been cast and sending new ballots to everyone, regardless of whether they requested a new ballot. The court case aimed to clear up possible ballot confusion after former Vice President Walter Mondale was nominated as a last-minute replacement for Wellstone, who was killed in a plane crash on Friday. President Bush was in South Bend, Indiana this afternoon as part of last-minute campaigning for Republican candidates in key races across the nation. Marianne Holland reports from member station WVPE.
President Bush's afternoon stop in South Bend was the third on behalf of Republican businessman Chris Ciccola. Ciccola's opponent is former three-term Congresswoman Democrat Jill Long Thompson. The president reiterated the themes of previous campaign speeches across the country.
We'll work to make sure every child is educated. We'll make sure the health care system is relevant. There's a lot we can do. But our number one priority will be to protect you, because there's an enemy out there which hates America.
President Bush also restated that if the United Nations doesn't approve military action against Iraq, the United States will act alone. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Holland in South Bend.
A federal grand jury in Houston has indicted the former chief financial officer of Enron Corporation. Andrew Fastow is charged with 78 counts of fraud, conspiracy, money laundering, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors say Fastow organized a plan to hide Enron's losses and made its profits seem much higher than they really were. Russia is ruling out any possibility of holding talks with Chechen separatist leaders, alleging they were behind last week's hostage standoff in a Moscow theater in which 119 captives were killed. NPR's Lauren Sheets reports from Moscow.
A Kremlin spokesman said the Russian military would, quote, wipe out what's left of the Chechen separatist hierarchy, including its leader Aslan Maschadov. Russian officials played phone recordings in which hostage takers claim Maschadov had approved what Moscow calls the worst terrorist raid in its history. The Russians displayed bombs recovered from the theater where the hostages were held, saying there was enough explosive power to have brought down the building. Maschadov denies involvement and condemned the hostage taking. Russian forces have also stepped up operations in Chechnya itself. Witnesses say Russian troops have surrounded a Chechen refugee camp near the war-torn region's administrative border. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
In stocks, the Dow lost 30 points to close at 83.97. The Nasdaq gained 3 to close at 13.29. This is NPR News. The government has gone to court to block a merger that would have created the nation's largest satellite TV service. Antitrust enforcers say the proposed merger between EchoStar Communications Corporation and Hughes Electronics would harm consumers. NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
The Justice Department in 23 states filed a suit in federal court to stop the merger. They said it would eliminate competition between the nation's two biggest direct broadcast satellite services, Hughes DirecTV and EchoStar's Dish Network. They argued it would give EchoStar, quote, control of the skies and create a monopoly in areas where cable television is not available. In most U.S. markets with access to cable, the deal would have reduced the number of pay TV competitors from 3 to 2. The company said the merger would enhance service. They had tried to placate antitrust enforcers by offering to sell off some of their satellite capacity to cable operator Cablevision System Corporation. But that wasn't enough to satisfy the Justice Department. Kathleen Schalk, NPR News, Washington.
Ballistics tests have linked the rifle used in the Washington, D.C. area sniper murders with killings in two other states. The police chief in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, said murder warrants have been issued for John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo in the murder of a beauty shop worker in late September. Police in Montgomery, Alabama, say ballistic evidence shows that a rifle found in Muhammad's car was used in a robbery at a liquor store in September that left one woman dead and another wounded. Muhammad and Malvo have already been charged in that case, along with 10 killings and 3 woundings in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 5 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The film Secretary is an unusual comedy about an unusual office romance, a sadomasochistic relationship between a young woman and the lawyer she works for. The movie is adapted from a short story by Mary Gateskill. My guest is the director of the film, Stephen Schoenberg. He also directed Hit Me, which is based on a Jim Thompson crime novel. When David Edelstein reviewed Secretary on Fresh Air, he described it as a film about two monumentally damaged people who might actually be freed from their psychological shackles by acting out a master-slave relationship. Here's a scene shortly after Lee Holloway, the secretary, has started working for Mr. Gray, the lawyer. He's just asked her into the office to discuss her typing errors on the letter she just gave him, but this feedback session takes an unexpected turn that ends with him smacking her behind. The secretary is played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who is the sister of actor Jake Gyllenhaal. Mr. Gray is played by James Spader.
Now, I want you to bend over the desk so you're looking directly at it. Get your face very close to the letter and read the letter aloud.
I don't understand.
There's nothing to understand. Put your elbows on the desk. Bend over. Get your face close to the letter and read it aloud.
Dear Mr. Garvey, I'm grateful to you for referring...
Continue.
Stephen Schoenberg, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to introduce the two main characters in Secretary.
Well, the male lead is played by James Spader. Mr. Gray is a small-town lawyer who is living a very isolated life, not caring too much about his law practice, which he doesn't do particularly well in. And he engages in sadomasochistic activities in his office with his secretaries. But he has never met a secretary quite like Lee Holloway, who is played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who comes to his office having been in a mental hospital and has never really worked in the world. She's 23, 22, 24 years old, somewhere in there. And she gets a job as his secretary, and what evolves between them is a what is generally looked upon as a sadomasochistic relationship, but it becomes sort of a beautiful, gentle love affair, much to his surprise and much to her surprise. So the things which he has done with other secretaries sort of goes further with her and evolves into something much more simultaneously threatening and tender.
What are some of the things he makes her do?
Well, he does things on the tamer side. He sort of plans her day very thoroughly and controls what she eats eventually and spanks her by having her lean over his desk whenever she makes a typing mistake. He sort of takes her into a realm of sexuality and feeling, which is really the primary thing that's going on in the film, is what is he actually making her feel, not so much what is he doing to her. But he sort of opens a door in her life that she probably didn't know anything about before meeting him.
In the opening scene of Secretary, Lee, the young woman who becomes the secretary, is just getting out of a psychiatric hospital. She's a cutter, a self-mutilator. She has a little, under the bed, she keeps a little box of knives and files that she uses to mutilate herself. What is the connection you see in her psychological and emotional life between self-mutilation and the kind of sadomasochistic relationship she gets into with her boss, the lawyer?
Well, one of the things about self-mutilators, and it's funny because there's very little that you actually see in the film. You never actually see her cut herself. You never see any blood. You never see any skin break. What you actually see is her contemplating cutting herself and struggling with whether or not she should cut herself or will cut herself. But there's a fetishistic quality about both of these things. She keeps a little box under her bed, and that has the quality of almost as if it's a little box of sex toys. And the intensity of feeling which somebody is after when they cut themselves is somewhat similar to the intensity of feeling, just on a very fundamental level, that somebody is after when they are hit by someone, when they're struck or when they're spanked. And so you have a character who is after some kind of real visceral experience. And the other thing is that someone like that has a lot of feeling, but it's contained kind of below the surface and is very protected. And a cutter, if you read the literature on them, you know, the psychoanalytic literature, you find that there are people who are extremely sensitive, actually, and they want to metaphorically get something out. They want access somehow to all that feeling. And I think that that's somewhat similar to somebody who needs to be struck by their lover or their husband or their wife in order to feel something. So there is a similarity. The difference in my mind, and one of the keys, I think, to the film, is that her self-mutilation is occurring in total isolation, separate from everybody. She has to do it by herself, kind of hidden almost in the dark in her room. And the experience that she has with Mr. Gray is intimate with somebody else. It's as if she's admitting somebody else into that private world. And I think we may underestimate how important that is and how freeing that is, and how, just in everybody's life, the difference between having an experience by yourself, whether it's scary or tender, and having it with somebody else.
Well, that's one of the almost comic aspects of your movie, is that a sadomasochistic relationship seems almost really sociable and healthy by comparison to locking yourself in your room and cutting yourself.
Well, I think a sadomasochistic relationship is healthy compared to many relationships that we have out there in the world.
Well, where do you come into in all this? What's your doorway into this subject of self-mutilation and sadomasochism?
Well, the thing that interests me, and one of the reasons that I was drawn to making the movie in the first place, is I'm very interested in the ways in which people bridge their isolation, however they do that. So in general, I find characters who are in some way cut off, shut down, unable to communicate how they really feel, totally compelling. You know, so these two people in the film, Mr. Gray and Lee Holloway, James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal, are so sort of alone in what they're doing and in how they're functioning in their lives. And the fact that they're able to bridge that and find love together, to me, is incredibly beautiful and moving. So that's my access to it. I mean, I feel like it's funny, you know, obviously the hook of the film is sadomasochism. You know, James Spader spanks Maggie Gyllenhaal. That's, you know, the pizzazz of it. But I think when people go into the film and they sit through it, they discover, lo and behold, that there's something really beautiful happening. And to me, that's what was so compelling.
Yeah, I want to make something clear. It's not like you're really showing much sex on the screen. So I don't want people to think that this is like a triple X rated movie or anything. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the pleasing things about the movie is that you don't see very much at all. I mean, most of it is about
mind
how
games
these two... It's about the mind, exactly.
You have to be really careful with a film like Secretary that the tone is right. Otherwise, the film can appear very silly or inappropriately brutal, which is not what you're going for. Were there movies that you watched that have to do with out-of-the-mainstream love or sexuality, and movies that became kind of markers for you of, like, what can go right and what can go wrong in that kind of movie? Movies to emulate and movies to really avoid.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are films that I looked at. Obviously, you go, if you're looking at films about sexuality and, say, edgier sexuality, you go back automatically and look at Last Tango, you know, and sort of move from there. And, you know, I looked at the Japanese film In the Realm of the Senses, and I looked at Buñuel, and I looked at a film that came out recently called An Affair of Love, a French film. And these are all movies. I think the essential problem with movies about sex is when you make the movie about the sex, you get nothing. Because that the thing which makes any kind of sex scene, and as you were saying earlier, there's really very little that you see in Sex Secretary. But when you make a movie about sex, you have to make a movie about character. You have to make the movie about what does the sex mean to these people. And that better be something substantial. If it isn't something substantial, all you get is a well-photographed body.
My guest is Steven Shainberg, director of the film Secretary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Steven Shainberg, director of the film Secretary. What are some of the issues you had to face in getting distribution for Secretary, issues that might have arisen out of the subject matter of the film, self-mutilation, sadomasochistic relationships?
Well, you know, people were afraid of the movie all the way down the line. I mean, from trying to get a script financed to trying to find the right producer to work with on the project, to actors who automatically said no. My original list of editors on the film consisted of 7 women editors in New York City, none of whom would even meet with me after reading the script. And I would say to the producers, but let me at least talk to them. I can tell them, you know, I'm not going to make the dark and creepy and scary version. I'm going to make the other version. So when we took the film to Sundance, there was a lot of interest from distributors, but they were very scared. And we won at Sundance the Special Jury Prize for Originality, which I think is just an absolutely delightful and exciting award, and a strange award. And subsequent to that, distributors started coming around much, much more aggressively. But, you know, it took a long time at each stage of the process for me to convince people that the film could be gentle and caring and could be revelatory and fairy tale like, and that it wasn't going to be a, you know, softcore porn film or a film that would send people out of the theaters, that it could actually be a Friday night date movie. So it took us a long time.
Now, you already had experience in making a movie that had very, very, very little distribution. You made a film adaptation of a Jim Thompson novel, and your movie was called Hit Me. It starred Elias Koteas. It played very few places, and it hasn't even come out yet on video. It will be coming out next year on video and DVD. Was that a very discouraging experience?
Well, you know, it's funny because You know, in certain ways, yes, but in certain ways, no, because basically what I made a film when I made Hit Me that was trying to be absolutely true to Jim Thompson's voice. And it's a very dark and funny, weird, sad and troubled voice. And I felt that although a lot of other films had been made from his novels, The Grifters, After Dark My Sweet, two French films, I felt that they had basically done Jim Thompson light. And I didn't want to do Jim Thompson light. I wanted to do Jim Thompson for real. And I think I did. And the fact that, you know, the movie has its fans for sure and was one of the things that made it possible to get Secretary made, I think I was in a, you know, a different place in my life than in terms of what I wanted to make. And after having made a very sort of strong and visceral, not to say it's not funny, film, I wanted to do something softer. You know, I wanted to do a love story. And so in a certain way, making that film made it possible to make Secretary. I think if I hadn't made Hit Me, I wouldn't have been able to come to Secretary with a gentler and even sort of more unusual sense of humor. I don't think I would have gotten that out of my system yet.
What did you have to get out of your system?
Well, I was, you know, at the time when I made Hit Me, I was living an entirely different life. I was living in Los Angeles. I was essentially dealing with a lot of more difficult life circumstances. And I think I was a heavier person and a more kind of aggressive person in terms of my attitudes about filmmaking. So, you know, it made sense to go and make a film like that. It came out of me.
So in a way, would I be too reductive to say that Hit Me is about life is miserable and you're going to be lonely and things will really be bad? And Secretary is, you know, life is filled with pain and you're lonely and life is bad, but there's a possibility of actually making human connection and turning things around.
Yeah, but I think I would. I think that's kind of a great comparison. If I was still seeing a psychiatrist, I would bring that in today, and we would talk about that for the entire session. But you know, I think Secretary is even more playful than that. I think it's more kind of joyful and kind of looking for humor in places that you would least expect to find it, and I love that about it.
My guest is Steven Schoenberg. He's the director of the new film, Secretary. What are some of your all-time favorite movies?
Well, goodness, anything by David Lynch would be number one, probably. Blue Velvet was the film that really made me want to make movies. So I just, you know, look at everything that Lynch does as if, you know, I'm going to school. But certainly, you know, Kubrick and Polanski and, you know, I still go back and look at all of Scorsese's films probably every year. And, you know, Mike Lee as well. And I have sort of a weirdly dual personality where I'm interested in things that look beautiful, but I hate things that are overwhelmed by style. And so I'll look at a film by Mike Lee, like Life is Sweet, and feel like I'm sort of being cleansed, you know, almost the way some writers will talk about reading Hemingway. You know, we have to, I try to, you know, my aspiration is to make things that I love to look at, that are visually exciting, but are essentially about people. And I think that's a rarity, you know. Movies so seldom now are just about human beings. It's so much more about, you know, explosions or special effects or what have you.
You said the Blue Velvet was the movie that made you want to make movies. How old were you when you saw it? And what did you really love about it? Like, what scenes really reached you the most? Or what about the overall story or movie? Yeah.
Well, you know, how old was I? I guess I was probably 20. How long? Well, I'm 39, so I'm not sure how long ago that was. But I was probably 23, 24, maybe something like that, 22. Mm-hmm. You know, Blue Velvet was, it's just a beautiful dream. And I could talk about the film for a long time, but certainly it's his use of color and the sense of mystery and the sense of wonderment about things that are scary. You know, I remember reading a quote from David Lynch, and I probably won't get this exactly right, but he said something like, you know, there are a lot of interesting textures in the gutter. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh my God, you know, it's like there's a whole world out there that cinematically and visually and artistically that is discounted. And it's not necessarily things that are overtly ugly, because he certainly makes things that are just mesmerizingly beautiful to look at. But the film felt like, Blue Velvet to me felt like it was opening a door onto something dreamlike and unconscious and incredibly moving and also undecipherable, and something which can't exactly be articulated. And I love that, you know, that it's not, you can't say exactly what it is that Kyle MacLachlan is experiencing in that film. And, you know, that whole ability to kind of tread into the unknown, for me, was just kind of, you know, very opening.
Stephen Schoenberg is director of the film Secretary. It's in many theaters now. Secretary and his earlier film Hit Me will each be released on video and DVD around March. Schoenberg will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, the debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Stephen Schoenberg, director of the film Secretary. Also, we talk with jazz singer Susie Arioli and guitarist Jordan Officer. Their swing band is based in Canada. And film critic David Edelstein recommends some modern horror movies for tonight.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Steven Shainberg, director of the offbeat comedy Secretary, about a young secretary and the lawyer she works for, two very damaged people who find liberation in a sadomasochistic relationship. Shainberg also directed the film Hit Me, which is based on a Jim Thompson crime novel. Earlier in our interview, he said that Blue Velvet is one of his favorite films, and it helped inspire him to make movies. There's a scene in Blue Velvet in which Isabella Rossellini and Kyle MacLachlan are beginning a relationship, and she says to him, who is much younger and more innocent, she says to him, "Hit me." Did that help inspire the title of your movie, Hit Me?
God, Terry, you found me out. That's where the title comes from. Good Lord. Yes, it is.
Oh, it is.
Absolutely.
I thought you were making fun of me for a second.
No, I'm not. I'm startled. You're the only person who's ever found me out. But that is actually where the title comes from. Yes.
Oh, well, good.
The book was called the Jim Thompson book was called A Swell Looking Babe, which is a title that I absolutely abhor. So, I was always looking for a new title, and the film has a lot to do with revelations, as in, oh my God, it hit me. And it also has to do with card playing. And Elias Koteas actually does slap somebody across the face in the movie. So there's a lot of ways in which the words hit me play in that film. But the original impetus was her whispering to Kyle MacLachlan.
Why that scene? Why did you want to pay homage to that scene? I mean, why did that scene stick in your mind so much? The hit me scene.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a scene where, first of all, the words hit me were applicable to the film. So if I hadn't had a movie that involved poker and that had Elias Koteas' character having several kind of startling revelations about who he actually is and things like that, I would never have used the words. But the scene is... in my mind, so much about Isabella Rossellini's character asking for something which she's afraid to ask for and which reveals something so tender about herself and which eventually in Blue Velvet, Kyle MacLachlan is willing to do for her out of affection. And there's enormous ironies, obviously, in the two sentences that I've just said. But that irony is in the film Hit Me, too. The irony of falling in love with somebody from whom you're going to learn probably some scary things about yourself, which is what falling in love always involves.
It seems to me you're examining something very similar, but from a completely different angle in Secretary.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, I think that love relationships are much more complicated than they're usually portrayed on film. And I think it's incredibly exciting to try to get at some of the deeper things that go on when two people meet and end up together.
Do you walk around thinking that a lot of people don't really admit to some of the complex, disturbing feelings they really have?
Yeah. I mean, you know, both my parents were psychoanalysts. And at the dinner table when I was a kid, my sister and I would be treated to the most wonderful conversation about who said what that day and what the hell was really going on. You know, and so my fundamental belief is that, you know, just on the most sort of simple level, we all wear some kind of mask. And the most exciting thing with somebody else or in the movies is to see the mask removed. And when you see the mask removed, you see something essentially beautiful because you're seeing somebody for what they are.
So I'm wondering, when your parents were sitting around the dinner table with you going over all these unusual case studies of, you know, unusual psychological behavior, were they then expecting you to be perfectly normal?
Well, you know, that's the word normal is an interesting thing, you know. I mean, obviously there are schizophrenics who we can say are, let's say, abnormal, who are actually, delusional. But working your way backward from there, I'm not quite sure where we should draw the line normal in the sand. I mean, I don't think the behaviors that Mr. Gray and Lee Holloway are displaying in Secretary, I don't think that those behaviors are abnormal. They're not. Many people are not spanking their wife or their husband, but something else is going on. And that doesn't mean sexually. There's some kind of thing that's hidden, that's secretive, that you don't know about. And this occurs in all relationships. So, it's interesting to try to think about what are my own prejudices about other people. That's normal. This isn't. This is okay. That's not. And I think, certainly the film is addressing that. And it's one of the things that really interests me and probably comes out of my background.
Stephen Shainberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Stephen Shainberg directed the film Secretary. It's in many theaters now. Secretary and his earlier film Hit Me will each be released on video and DVD around March. Coming up, the Susie Arioli Swing Band. This is Fresh Air. Always looking out for new jazz singers, and I recently heard a young Canadian singer that I wanted you to hear too. Her name is Susie Arioli. She has a swing band based in Montreal. We invited her to talk with us, along with her guitarist, Jordan Officer. Here's the opening track from their latest CD, Pennies from Heaven. Susie Arioli not only sings, she plays drums.
Every time it rains pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? You'll find your fortune falling all over town. Make sure that your umbrella is upside down. Treat it for a package of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, you must have showers. So anytime it thunders, don't go under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you and me.
I asked Susie Arioli if she sings while seated behind the drums.
Actually, I stand in front with just a snare. And the snare is up kind of like cocktail snare height so that, I can, just stand there and play. And I have a mic on the brushes and a mic on the vocals. And so then I have Jordan on one side and Shane on the other. We kind of make a slight semicircle. And that's cool because we can still see each other. And the brushes are present, and they're present in the monitors, and they're present in the mains, and it's a thick, beguiling sound because, in a way, you're not. It's true. It could be a kit in the back, not mic'd, But in fact, it's just the brushes that are mic'd, and it's really fun for me to do.
Is it ever hard to coordinate the singing and the drumming?
Sometimes, man, yeah. On the really slow ones, I feel I get a little self-conscious, I have to say.
What makes you self-conscious on the ballads?
Well, I guess because there's a lot of space, which is something that I really, really love with this band, is that there's lots of space to breathe, lots of silence to put in perspective. And if you're clomping along with your loud, I don't know, you know, sometimes you think you're a big clomping around like person and you're not, but you just think you have this, it's just so loud, you know, it's so present in the mic, you know, this suddenly the swish is all you hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Susie is such a great drummer for what we're doing. We played with a couple of drummers, like when we were just starting to play together, we played with different setups, and it's really when we started playing with Susie on the snare that that's one of the things that really gave the band its sound, and it just fit perfectly with what we were doing.
Susie, have you studied singing?
I did take a little bit of classes with a woman a couple of years ago, I guess about 10 years ago, and that was really useful. She laid out, she kind of scientificalized what it was to sing and everything, so that was good. I learned a lot from that. But I didn't follow through with any studies since then. I guess I listen and imitate, listen and imitate. That's a great way to learn, I found for myself,
mm-hmm.
to imitate completely as close possible as you can. It's really a great way to learn different types of singers, you know, how different types approach stuff, like, you know, their phrasing will be so straight or whatever, so behind the beat. And when I first started singing, of course, I imitated subconsciously, I suppose, the person I was most listening to at the time, and that was Billie Holiday. So I was kind of like singing in somebody else's voice. And my mother kind of gave me some really good advice, which was to stop singing like Billie Holiday. That was like the main criticism she had of my first performance was, well, what are you doing, you know, like... singing with somebody else's voice, you know, putting a mask on, you know. So that's good, whatever. You have both sides, you got to imitate, and then you got to find your own voice.
Jordan, how did you and Susie meet?
Well, we met at parties and jam nights. We had a lot of musician friends in common. And this guy, Stephen Berry, is... a blues musician in Montreal. He has a band. He's had a band for 25 years, and he almost always has a jam night somewhere or another. And then at one of Stephen's jams, we were playing at the jam night, and the owner wanted to hire us as a band. And we said, well, we don't have a band, but, well, this is the band, you know. Whoever was on stage at the time became the band, so me and Susie and Stephen and Gordy did some shows together and quickly learned... got together enough tunes for a night of music, and so it's whatever tune Susie liked to sing. And so there were jazz tunes and blues and country and like Nina Simone tunes, soul. But then we just gravitated more and more toward the jazz and started learning more and more of those kind of tunes because it fit best.
So you ended up being partners off stage as well as on stage. If you don't mind my mentioning this, there's a fairly big age discrepancy between the two of you.
Yeah, he's a lot older than me.
Yeah. Susie, you're like mid or late 30s, and Jordan, you're in your late 20s?
Yeah.
Mid-20s?
You're such a sweetie.
So it was what, like at least 10 years, right?
Yeah.
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 So, but you know what interests me about that? It's like you're both playing music that's not associated with your age at all.
It's true.
It's not associated with your era at all.
No, it's not even our parents.
Exactly. It precedes your parents' era by decades. So the fact that you are, you know, comparatively far apart age-wise seems to almost decrease with meaning since you're musically living in a world that's so... So not in your age anyway?
Right.
Well, that's an interesting way of
saying
it.
Yeah, I like that. That makes everything balanced out, you know?
Susie, one of your influences is Billie Holiday. And on the new CD, you do a song associated with Billie Holiday, Don't Explain. But you do it really pretty differently than she did. Can you talk a little bit about approaching this song that is so associated with another singer?
Well, one of the reasons I'm influenced by Billie Holiday is that, like, when Billie Holiday is writing that song, writing those lyrics and singing, it's like, that's her life, you know? That's her, what she's living at the time. And that, to me, is heavy, you know? So when I'm singing it, I'm not, you know, I've lived, whatever, I've had crappy experience, let's say, in love, but I've never had the type of heavy-duty drama that Miss Holiday had. So I think that my approach is therefore less guttural, you know? It's less heavy, it's less trenchant, you know? It's more, I can relate to the emotion in a way, I can sympathize, I can try to empathize, I can feel compassionate about it, I can take it, you know, really objectively, like a story, but it's a beautifully lyricized story, a great subject matter, you know, and this fabulous melody, and it's like, it's a beautiful piece of art to exploit. But, you know, a lot of the songs she sings are much more heavy when coming from her than from coming from some happy-go-lucky sprite like me, you know?
Singer and drummer Susie Arioli and guitarist Jordan Officer. The latest Susie Arioli swing band CD is called Pennies from Heaven. From it, here's Don't Explain, featuring Ralph Sutton on piano. This was his last recording session before his death at the age of 79.
Hush now, don't explain. You've been out there raising Cain. I'm glad you're back. Don't explain.
Susie Arioli Swing Band. Coming up, some contemporary horror movies for Halloween night. This is Fresh Air. If you like to stay home on Halloween and rent a horror movie, film critic David Edelstein has some contemporary horror films to recommend.
I watch horror movies all year long, but only on Halloween do I feel emboldened to preach the gospel of the morbid, the gross, and the disreputable. These movies are candy for the brain. No, they're not sweet, but they're messy and indulgent, and if they're really good, they leave you feeling bad. You won't be sure whether you've exorcised some demons or been present at the birth of a big mess of new ones. I also love horror movies because they're worst-case scenarios. What in a normal movie is a creepy little subtext? In a horror movie is a riptide that swallows the guilty, the innocent, and everyone in between. The latent is now the blatant, with the heart of darkness beating like a bass drum in a Sousa march. It's okay if you prefer your symphonies of the human condition more nuanced, but there is something splendidly crystallizing about the monstrous archetype. When we consider the ways in which scientific advancement outpaces moral understanding, we turn to Frankenstein. When we meditate on our duty to repress our bestial instincts for the sake of civilization, we invoke Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And we have vampirism to cover a whole host of appetites for sex or drugs or immortality, big issues. For Halloween week, I've decided to celebrate some of my favorite modern metaphoric horror films, not the ones with Brand X boogeymen in masks, the ones that grapple with the same issues as mainstream movies, but in a language more ferocious and insane. Take The Brood, which David Cronenberg wrote and directed in 1979 after an ugly divorce and custody battle. He said it was his Kramer versus Kramer. He said he wanted to show the cost of a hellishly bad marriage on the next generation and the next. In his previous horror pictures, They Came From Within and Rabid, Cronenberg explored the monsters that arise when people keep their traumas bottled up. The Brood is the antithesis. It's what happens when, in the name of therapy, you go too deep and too far. Here's Oliver Reed as a psychiatrist called Raglan, coaching Samantha Egger through some unpleasant memories of Mommy.
You're being so unfair, sweetheart. Mommies never do that. Mommies never hurt their own children.
You did hurt me. You beat me and you scratched me. You threw me down the stairs.
Show me what I did. Don't stop it now, darling. You show me. Show me your anger, Nola. Show it to me. Go all the way through it. Go all the way through it to the end. Right to the end.
For Raglan, going all the way through it means going until it shows up on your body as a boil or a rash, or in the case of Samantha Egger, homicidal mutant babies that take a hammer to people you dislike. Some critics have accused Cronenberg of being anti-feminist in The Brood. I think he's despairingly anti-everything. Anti-marriage, anti-childbearing, anti-therapy, but furiously pro-horror. For a horror picture just as explosively original, but more female-centric, try Ginger Snaps, directed by John Fawcett, from a script by Karen Walton. Imagine a werewolf movie starring the two alienated goth best friends of Ghost World, teenage girls who've managed by sheer will to delay the onset of menstruation. One of them, Ginger, gets her period and gets bitten that same night by a werewolf. The other, her younger sister Bridget, watches in horror as Ginger first becomes sexually active, then grows a tail, then begins ripping people to shreds. The critic Linda Ruth Williams described these sisters as staring at each other from either side of the pubescent divide. Name a mainstream problem drama, and I'll give you a more amazing variation in the horror genre. Maybe you like male adolescent misfit movies like Igby Goes Down or Ordinary People. Try George R. Romero's grueling Martin about a tormented teenager who reaches out to women by drinking their blood. Maybe you like drug addiction movies. You'll never see anything like Frank Henenlotter's Brain Damage, in which a young man acquires a parasite called Elmer, which looks like a cross between a giant phallus and South Park's Mr. Hanky the Christmas Poo. He talks like Bing Crosby, and he sucks people's brains out. Elmer keeps the young man a slave by drenching his synapses with a blue, heroin-like opiate. It's as vivid as Requiem for a Dream, and a lot funnier.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Here's music from David Cronenberg's film, The Fly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track by the rap group Run DMC. Their DJ, Jam Master Jay, was shot to death last night in a recording studio in Queens.
Yo, Jay! Wait.
What?
Wait.
Two. Three.
Hip, 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 hip,
hip. What?
Day when I was chilling in Kentucky Fried Chicken. Just minding my business, eating food and finger licking. This dude walked in, looking strange and kind of funny. Went up to the front with a menu and his money. He didn't walk straight, kind of side to side. He asked this old lady,
yo, yo, is this Kentucky Fried?
The lady said, yeah, smiling. He smiled back. He gave a quarter and his order.
Small fry.
Big Mac!
You be illin'. Yo, illin'. What you tell that kid?
You be illin'. Illin'. You be illin'. Illin'. You be
illin'.
You finally wake up, Doc's gone to town. Round his back, through the hoop, then you scream,
touchdown!
You be illin', illin'. You be illin', illin'. You be illin', illin'.
Don't you tell that kid,
you be illin'. The other day around the way I see.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And from DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Bing Crosby changed pop singing in the 20s and 30s. We talked to jazz critic Gary Giddens about his biography of Crosby. It's just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.